General Duncan Reel 7, you have stressed that Hope revolutionized training when he came to the depot battalion, and that he used the tank corps as the
tank crew,
as the focus of his new training methods. But exactly what impact did he make?
He started off, instead of taking a squad of 20 men under a non-commissioned officer, under two non-commissioned officers, his squad of 20 men were divided into five tank crews, and one man was appointed the leader of the crew, and he worked underneath, directly underneath his sergeant. He also evolved an entirely new drill for the tank corps. Instead of marching up and down the barrack square and forming fours and turning to the right and forming on the left and that sort of thing, he didn't do that. He marched as a deployed tank formation, either a troop or a company or even as a regiment, with your leaders in front, when you were doing formal drill, with the crew indicated by two ropes held by the remaining four chaps, with the signals, and the signals were given to adopt various formations, ranging from line ahead to line. And there were special signals for these. And the responsibility was placed all the time on the crew leader. You see, the crew leader was the chap of the commander. And all the time he was searching for the commanders, for the chaps who were going to come out on top. It had the most remarkable effect. I mean, I now number among my close friends chaps who were crew leaders who became to command regiments, squadrons and regiments in the regiment during the last war. And coupled with that, a very much longer period, the schools were brought into this, and the recruit went to do his driving maintenance training in the recruit wing of the central schools, and he went over to Gibson Lulworth for the same thing, and his period of training went up from 22 weeks to 36 weeks. Was 9 months. And during at the end of that time, the chap who was the good chap who was turned out was a potential NCO anyway. And he was basically trained. He'd probably driven. He'd driven cars and tanks quite a long way. He'd actually fired the guns we had on the range. And he was altogether an infinitely more valuable person than his predecessors. Now, coupled with that went the non-commissioned officer, you see, because he then proceeded to raise the status of the non-commissioned officer to a quite immeasurable degree.
How did he do that?
Starting off with the ground, one of the early non-commissioned officers who came up for some minor misdemeanor. And I can see old John Hope sitting there looking at him and saying, but you know, you're an officer, non-commissioned, true, but you're an officer. And officers don't behave like that. It's neither honest nor fitting their station. And I watched the expression on this chap's face change. It was quite remarkable. I watched it changed all round, and the word went round just like lightning. And you began then, this is a time when you began to lay the foundation for what I reckon is the most marvellous corps of non-commissioned officers that I've ever even seen. And this went on, and of course equally with that, a much higher standard was demanded from the officer, much, much higher. And in order to emphasise this point, I was his mouthpiece. You are responsible for drill, discipline, and deportment. And what you say is what I say. And he then divorced himself. And I virtually commanded that living depot, which used to run up to a couple of thousand men at a time. And I was quite correct. I've never wielded such power again.
What was he doing while you were wielding all his power?
Oh, he was running around in the background. He was going around in the background and giving me rocket after rocket. It was here for errors in judgment and that sort of thing. But this was all, in other words, I was being trained in exactly the same way that the little boy in charge of five men was being trained. He was a wonderful, he was a born trainer, never happier than when he was teaching. He was a man of great military knowledge, great military wisdom, a countryman, crazy on a horse, historian and archaeologist, one of the most widely read men I ever knew, had an enormous effect on me.
It sounds, from what you say, as if his major, Colonel Hope's major contribution was in the field of morale, in the raising of the sense of commitment to the Corps amongst NCOs and officers. But more on the, what one might almost call the psychological side, than on basic skills side.
Oh, no. The basic skills were, the basic skills, you see, again, he was an extremely able soldier. No, I don't think so. That's not correct. His standard on the basic skills was as high as anybody's ever seen or known, probably higher than most. But he superimposed on this all this enormous boost in morale. That's really what it amounts to.
Yes. Well, you described the way in which he innovated on the morale side. Did he innovate on the basic skills side as well? Because you haven't stressed that side yourself so much.
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, no, because you see, I wonder why. Because really, his other achievements on the, if you like, morale side, were really so important as far as the Corps was concerned that, if you like, in a way, they overshadow the basic skill side. But he was a perfectionist in terms of drill, of general weapon efficiency, shooting positions, tactics, much better than most. He was a survival, in actual fact. He was a countryman of 20 years ago. A countryman of pre-First World War who'd acquired a great deal of skill as a fighting soldier, a jolly good fighting soldier. Mm. He was originally a 60th himself, a regiment for whom I've got the greatest admiration. There are no bad ones, they drowned them at birth. And those who are good, of course, are so unbelievably good it isn't true.
Mm. How would you compare, both in style and importance, the relative contributions to the depot made by the two COs you served under?
Carlton laid the most wonderful foundation for Jumbo to build on.
Well, that's it in a nutshell. Would you like to expand it a little?
I don't think so. Carlton got the depot organized, disciplined, gave it a sense of purpose in itself, Jumbo built on that, an enormous self-confidence. I think that's it. Their self-confidence, which was based on the fact that most of the time they were asked to do more and more and more impossible things, and were surprised to find that they were perfectly able to do it. And kept on doing it. They stupid saying there are no difficulties. There weren't any difficulties. They weren't allowed to be there. The soldier who encountered difficulties and said he couldn't face them, was just blasted off face the earth and found he could do them. That's really what it meant. He was an incredible... Sorry. He was a great big chap. I also remember, with a great love of the English language, I remember one wretched dude, he said to me, come on, we go for a walk. And so we went for a walk, and unfortunately we went round the back quarters of the mess, which is a favourite hunting ground, when you were saying things you went to look at. Those were the sort of place. And he suddenly found some wretched little recruit about that high. And he said, what are you doing? So he said, I'm detailed for scullery fatigue, sir. Huh, scullion, are you? Well, be a good scullion then. And the chap went off wondering what the hell had hit him and what an earthy old man was talking about. This came in when they...
Sorry, would you start again?
Yes. We, I think, pioneered the introduction of psychological tests. One of the troubles, of course, was to find the particular trade for which the soldier had an aptitude. And after a great deal of discussion, which the trade unions brought in, among other things, we managed to get pay for the gunner as a gunner operator. There's no trade for a gunner, but there is a trade for an operator, a wireless set operator, and they eventually agreed that the men in the same corps could be categorized under either drivers, driver operators, or gunner operators. There was a problem there about training. We hadn't got a great deal of training time or equipment. We wanted to get the right man into the right job. And we had a succession of people down to try to evolve these sort of tests. The original ones we tried were primitive. They were really incredibly effective.
Describe them.
You gave a chap a box which had six or seven things in it. They sound stupid. One was a lock which was taken to pieces. One was an ordinary spring clothes peg which had been dissembled into its two bits and the spring. There was a wooden bearing which would go in one way and not the other way, the keys and that sort of thing. And he was then, on the word go, they took the lid off the box and there were these things and they were told that they had to be assembled made up into their whole. And out of that, in a very elaborate system of grading and marks and timings, you could classify people into the categories in which they were going to be trained. And I think at that time, as far as I remember, after he'd done after he'd done his original driving course, if he was destined to drive, he got an extra week at the end on driving, whereas the gunner operator either got an extra week gunning or an extra week operating, dependent on these tests. And the extraordinary thing was that they worked very well indeed. We had all sorts of chaps down. We all encouraged them. We asked them to come.
To advise you on their development? To advise you on the development of the test,
well,
you mean?
To see if they could produce any better theories. It was a thing which was very interesting. I can't remember the name of the chap. I think his name was Adam. It was Dr. Adam who came down. He had a whole heap of psychological tests, much more elaborate than ours, with revolving discs with spirals drawn on them. And the chap was asked to dot this, if he dotted it correctly. Then a light shone and the machines became more and more elaborate. And then they went from there, of course, to this modern psychological test, which is just a sheet of paper, you know, where you put in dots and strokes and say which is the same and which is different. But that was an interesting sort of sideline.
I was going to ask you, with this box of tricks that they had to work their way through, how did you measure their success? And then slot, and by what criterion were they allocated to the various jobs?
Well, I can't remember. There were more things that they had to assemble. It depended on the speed with which they did various things. That was really the amount. Where at the end of a certain time, you looked to see what they completed, and really clever chaps had completed a whole booming lot, and he was probably suitable for training either as a driver or as a gunner or as an operator. But that was the exact details that I don't remember, and unfortunately aren't written down anywhere now.
So you timed the individual operations and credited them for the speed with which they
more
did
or less,
them?
No, not necessarily. At one time they timed individual operations, and at other times they timed the box full.
I see.
But the exact details that I don't remember, but they had these psychiatry boys down.
Who had to, which of the functionaries within the tank crew had to get the highest marks?
I think the gunner operator. Operator. The operator is the chap who's got to be most alert. The driver's got to have great, we wanted him to have great skill with his fingers. But the driver operator, he wanted speed of reaction. Or the gunner operator.
I see.
But as I say, after all, this is 1930s, this is 46 years ago.
Yes.
You're respecting imagination a hell of a lot. Ordinary memory.
Well, should we move on to India?
Yeah.
To where you were posted at the beginning of 1931.
Yes.
8th Armoured Car Company, Delhi. What was the...
India is a sad story as far as I'm concerned. 8th Armoured Car Company in Delhi, across the armoured cars. I had a section. I was also a workshop officer there. I had a commanding officer who was the exact antithesis of Jumbo, who demanded absolute, who demanded meticulous attention to regulations and wasn't in the least concerned with speed. It wasn't a very constructive time as far as I was concerned.
The 8th Armoured Car Company had its base in Delhi.
They came down to Delhi. They came down off the frontier to Delhi. And I met them, my wife and I and one child met them actually in the fort. What of course was fun is to say that all the officers that came down there had come through my hands up on the officers' courses. Oh yes, now going back, now that is one thing. That one thing Jumbo was extremely insistent on was this question of the officers' training course. And instead of just merely having appearance at schools and appearance at gunnery and being taught odd bits of the depot. We got them in the depot, I think, for a fortnight at a time to begin with, and taught them our own particular form of tank drill, and then taught them a great deal about looking after men. I used to have them up, make them throw a dozen sets of equipment together on the floor in a heap and tell them, make them up into sets. Important to inspect men and how to look after men in much more detail than you've ever been able to do before, and what to do when they were confronted with a body of a troop for the first time, what they had to do, where you could, the problems which arose, which they'd have to face and so on, so that they were that much better equipped when they went out than they'd been before.
Hmm. Reverting to Delhi, you spent your entire year in Delhi, did you, before you were invalided home?
Wasn't even there a year, actually. I spent a large part of the year in Delhi. I then went up to the hills where I was, by that time I was extremely ill. And eventually I was classed as an invalid and at home.
Did the Armoured Car Company have duties within Delhi itself? Crowd control and things?
Internal security duties, yes. We were sent out several times on riot duty. Unsatisfactory, of course, because, as I say, the trouble with the armoured vehicle is that you can only use it for gun action or shock action. No, there was nothing. There was nothing there, you didn't even get the patrolling, the wide range patrolling as we used to get in Palestine, in the aid of the civil power. Very much sent out as backing to infantry soldiers.
Can you give me some specific instances of when you were called out on particular shows to support infantry?
Only one sticks in my mind. The Chandi Chowk, which is the big bazaar in Delhi, the main street. I remember being sent out in support of a company of York and Lancaster Regiment, riots which were going on, common riots. They've mostly been contained by the police. It was unbelievably hot. The temperature and the thermometer in the car before we went out registered 140 inside. And we were closed down and sweating like hell. Just merely standing at a street corner in case we should want it. This particular one, I was, an Indian agitator who spoke some English, who was weighing off about the English and trying to incite various people. And he knew enough not to get near the cars, which were electrified. The two cars had been turned over, or a car had been turned over in Peshawar. And the crew were extricated through the floorboard and slowly killed. And so they electrified them with Ford car coils. It wired up. The Ford car was a coil, was a trembler coil, so it generated its own electricity. Dropped a chain onto the ground and put the other end of the four coils onto the side of the car. Anybody who touched the car, of course, got the shock of his living life. And the trouble was, it kept on forgetting that damn thing was electrified yourself. It was very severe. Now, I could stand the chap no longer. We had hours to spend. We were just out of reach. I remember we took a cleaning rod and attached that to a piece of wire and attached that to the body of the car. And leaning out, I could just touch him behind the ear. Never seen a man jump so much. Went away and didn't bother us. But that was a sort of the stupid thing. And you could hear the roar of the crowd and you could see the police dealing with them. And they came up to the York and Langs, who were lined up across the road. And everybody sort of got ready.
Mm.
The most, of course, the chap I give absolutely full marks to. They used to lie down in front of the armored cars. This didn't happen to me, but it did happen to somebody in the tank. They lay down in the road and refused to move. And this chap wanted to get down. I think it was Chandi Chowke actually again. To expect, and they refused to move, and so he mobilized all the sweepers, who are the untouchable class. And these chaps went down the road with their brushes in front of the car like that. Of course, all the high-caste Hindus who were lying in the road got up and ran like a stag, fell there to examine it, and the car drove straight on.
Would you have any comments to make, in the light of your own experience, of the usefulness of armoured cars for crowd controls in Delhi? For controlling crowds in Delhi?
Only what I've already made. They're virtually useless. They're virtually useless for crowd control. They're wonderful for patrolling, and they can give you information now especially, you see, when they've all got wireless. They can give you information of exactly what's happening so that you can deal with them. But in actual fact, I should say myself that if a crowd is really out of hand, the only chap who can deal with them is the foot soldier. Whether you dismount your armoured car crews or not is a matter entirely for you.
Mm.
But that, this is a technique which has been perfected in Northern Ireland. And all we knew, we weren't equipped for that, but the York and Langs used rifle butts on the toes of Edmonton.
Precisely what did you find to be the limitations of the armoured cars for this kind of work?
The limitation is that its only offensive possibility is a gun. And if you're going to use guns on that scale, then you're going to have something like the Amritsar massacre all over again.
How far did they have a moral usefulness just by their presence?
I should think very little. It's like bluffing on a couple of twos. Rarely, because you know jolly well that there's nothing that you can do. I mean, if you suddenly produce four armored cars at the end of the street, a crowd will recoil. The crowd may go back then. If there's a policeman about or something like that, if the police are being hard-pressed, they may recoil temporarily and give the police the advantage of driving back again. If, on the other hand, there's nobody to control the crowd, they'll recoil, and somebody will say, "Pah, come on." They won't fire. You've been knowing jolly well they can't fire. And until you can't fire, until they do something which is worthy of fire.
So not only did you realise their uselessness, but the Indians realised their uselessness too.
Well, I'm not quite sure whether the Indians did or not. This is against the other thing. You see, you never know where they were going to fire. The conditions are in South Africa nowadays, you can say they're far. And that's that. And then they go there. Then, of course, the armored car has a great value.
Mm. Well, they persevered with them for a very long period of time in this kind of work.
Oh, but to be, you must remember that if the thing turns really serious, then the armored car, of course, has great value. If it turns really serious, if you have widespread arson and looting on the biggest scale, then the only answer is to shoot. And if you're going to shoot, then the armored car is ideal. You can go anywhere. It's invulnerable. Mm. Nobody can get at it. It takes fire to the place where it's required, with the firers under their own protection.
Did you find that working with armoured cars, for someone like yourself who was rather devoted to tanks, felt like a bit of a banishment?
Oh, no, not a bit. The tank and armoured car, the service of both of them was interchangeable as far as the tank corps was concerned. In very largely, the armoured car rally was much more fun because you had much greater mobility. You could go where you wanted. It was much more fun because if you wanted to take your crews up 20 miles and do a scheme like it, you could do it. You couldn't take tanks out under this. You had to get police clearance and the roads you couldn't go down because you'd break this and that and the other thing down.
So armoured car service was quite popular, was it?
Very. Mm. Oh, yes, indeed. And, of course, it was service in India. It was a new country. It was a new country, a new change of life, and that sort of thing. The only thing, of course, is that the two things we didn't know. One was the extensive use of salt. People used to suffer from heat stroke, but the heat stroke is pure exhaustion through sweating, through loss of body fluids. Well, you can check that now by salt. And the other thing, of course, is the topi. When I was in India, you wore a topi morning, noon, and night. And a soldier went out in the sun without one. It was jolly enough in the garden at once. But when I went out to India in 45, 6 weeks, I went out wearing a beret. I wore a beret through Delhi and Calcutta the whole time. And one could have made the soldier's life much, much pleasanter then, because virtually, you see, from 12 o'clock on after dinner, anyhow, to about 5 o'clock, they were shot up in their own bathrooms.
Had armoured cars improved in themselves, or had their ancillary equipment improved since your earlier service with them?
They'd improved. Yes, I think they probably had. The Crossley body was a much better body. It had two machine guns instead of one, with four alternative machine gun positions in a revolving turret. Commander had a cupola. The performance of the car wasn't as good as a Rolls, but outside that, the general cross-country performance hadn't improved to any marked degree because it was still a 4x2 drive. See, in comparison with the Lancaster, which came in 1929, which had six wheels and four of them driven. And of course, no comparison at all with the Saracen now, or the Daimler of the last war, which had four driven wheels, and the Saracen has six.
Was there any Was there any formal training program while you were in Delhi, or were you regarded as being on active service all the time?
Oh, no, it was a regular training program.
How was that organized?
Oh, by troops. By troops. You were submitted. Sorry, yes, you submitted your training program, which covered the individual training of the troop. That was the gun handling, the gun dismounting, and the gun staying, and that sort of thing. And your troop training, section training, we called them in those days, where you took them out and did the advance to contact and the withdrawal and taking up a position, taking up a fire position, that sort of thing, very largely left to the troop commander or the section commander. And then there should have been a company training, actually. I don't think we ever did in Delhi, not anyhow during the 8 months or so that I was active.
Mm. There's one thing which puzzles me about service with armoured cars as compared with service with tanks.